Okay, so a lot of you know that I grew up in a rather odd religion. As a child, I knew that I was living in the end times. The pastor told us not to expect to make it to adulthood without witnessing the return of Jesus Christ. As kids, we knew we were chosen because the apostle shared actual back and forth conversations that he had with the Lord. It was so much stunning nonsense. But I was a true believer until my late teens when I fled. And for years, I really didn't give that organization a whole lot of thought. Kind of like a hazily remembered nightmare. Did we really have to wash each other's dirty feet? Did we really preach that black people were cursed? Did we really prevent each other from seeing doctors? What was all of that about? Well, like I said, I tried to put it out of my mind. And then one day, I received an email. My church youth group, the Michigan chapter, was going to have a reunion. And at first, I was like, no way, no way. Leave the past to the past. But I kept thinking about it and thinking about it. And I figured, if it's on my mind this much, maybe I should get a plane ticket. So I did. And when I arrived at the hall, I couldn't get the grin off my face. People I'd known since diapers. We grew up in each other's houses. Some I hadn't seen in a couple decades. There were lots of hugs, lots of tears, and really, lots of love. To me, it felt like we had made it. Despite all the craziness, the fear, the mind games, the family breakup, we'd made it. And here we were. In that rented conference hall, I could feel the apostle. Now, long since dead, I could feel his shadow growing fainter. Still, his was the name we dare not speak. When I finally sat down to dinner, the woman next to me, she looked around and marveled. She said, "Can you believe that we all grew up in that wacky cult?" I lifted my glass to toast our freedom, and across from her, a woman who used to be my neighbor looked confused. She said sincerely, "What cult?" And just like that, it felt like this table of people who had known each other since before we could speak, we found ourselves on different sides of an expanse so wide that no ocean could ever fill it. We knew things about each other that our wives, our husbands, our therapists would never understand. But even then, we lived different stories. Today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present Reunion. Real stories from real people coming face to face with their own past. My name is Glenn Washington. Get ready. Buckle up. Because you're listening to Snap Judgment. We're going to kick off today's episode with one of the more unlikely reunion stories you're ever going to hear. Snap Judgment's Julia DeWitt has a story.
This is Roy.
I'm Roy Etteon Smith.
And Roy is a minister.
And been in the ministry for almost 25 years.
Back when his congregation was trying to get some money for a new building, he was feeling a lot of pressure to make good on his promise that he would find them the loans that they needed.
And kept promising the church, oh, you know, we're going to have a great property and everything's fine and, you know, the good Lord is going to work for us. And so I think I was in a point of desperation.
That's when he met this mortgage consultant. And the mortgage consultant said he would take care of all of it. So Roy just signed whatever paperwork the consultant handed to him. And it worked. They got the loans. They built their church. They started school. Everything went really well for about a year.
I picked up the phone one day, and it was an FBI agent. We were being actually accused of committing misrepresentation mortgage fraud.
Turns out the mortgage consultant, he had cooked the books. But because it was Roy's signature on all the falsified reports, it all came down on Roy.
I stood before a judge on sentencing day, and we went in very confident. We had plans for the rest of the evening. Judge, almost in an apologetic type of voice, she says, "Pastor, I have to set an example." And she sentenced me to 15 months of federal prison. I felt like I was getting life in prison. I felt like I was getting the electric chair. I felt like my life was over. And then I looked at my attorney, who promised me I was not going to prison, and he would not even look at me. He kept looking forward. I said, "Okay, well, if I'm going to prison, I want to be strong and be an example, you know, to the people who look up to me as dad, to people who look up to me as husband, to those who look up to me as pastor." And I told him God had a plan. And I don't know if I said that because I believed God had a plan. I think it was just a cliche to me at that moment. I had no idea. I showed up. It was snowing outside, and they gave me not even 10 seconds to say goodbye to my wife. Packed a duffel bag, like I don't know if I thought I was going on a camping trip or checking into the Days Inn. I don't know what I thought. But of course, when I arrived, you know, they gave me a strange look and took the duffel bag, like, you can't bring anything in here. I'm like, okay. And, you know, they put you in a holding cell until they process all your paperwork. And I'm in the holding cell all alone. I started thinking about my dad because that's the only person that I knew of that had ever been in a federal prison.
Roy never actually knew his dad growing up. His dad left before he was born.
As a child, I didn't know who he was. And I mean, I saw him, I think once when I was 7 years old, he showed up at our house. He stood in the doorway and he gave my sister a birthday gift or something. My mom saw a look on my face when I looked out the door, and you know, she says, "Oh, well, that's your dad." Would ask questions like, "Where does he live? And can I talk to him?" And she says, "No." She said, "I don't want you around him, and he's not a good influence for you." When I became a teenager, she began to talk about these terrible things that she experienced with him. You know, there was a lot of domestic violence, and I don't know, I started hating him.
Roy had spent his whole life trying to not be like his father. He went to college, he was a pastor. He had a wife and kids that he loved and he took care of. And still, he somehow ended up there in prison, just like his dad.
I started thinking like father, like son. And then there was parts of me that almost blamed him. You know, is this, you know, some sort of karma, or is this a generational curse? Was I bound to end up in prison because he was there? Then they came for me and said, "We're taking you upstairs for your orientation." Mr. Kuster, who was the counselor, said, "Let's just get to it." He says, "Now we need to talk about your bed assignment." When he told me who was in the room, I almost did a double take, because that's the same name as my biological father.
His dad was his cellmate.
I didn't want to believe it. I grew up most of my childhood hating this guy. And I always rehearsed in my mind that, you know, what I would say to him if I ever saw him. I thought it was some cruel punishment. "You're going to spend 15 months with this guy, and you guys are going to fight like cats and dogs, and you're going to confront him about every little thing he did to your mother." And I just wouldn't let myself believe it until I was escorted over to that building, and my dad was standing there to greet me. When I was not even a foot from him, it all changed. at that moment, all I wanted to do was touch him. Because, like, are you real? Are you really here? Am I really here with you? I kind of hugged him and I looked at him and I said, well, good afternoon. It was crazy. And it was hard to adjust. I couldn't open up to him. It wasn't like instantly father and son. You know, we were actually inmates. We were cellies for a while, actually. And I called him Mr. Milton.
For the first few weeks, they mostly just talked prison talk. They talked about the nurses in the clinic to avoid and about which vending machines were broken. But then, one day, Roy's dad pulled out a folder.
He said, look a here. You know, he always says, look a here. So he says, look a here. And, you know, in the folder, he had all of these newspaper clippings of when I graduated high school and I was in the newspaper for different things with school and when I got married and all types of stuff. So he has all these newspaper clippings and even my mom's obituary and all of the stuff that I'm like, wow. He saw a look on my face and he was like, uh-huh, you didn't know, did you? Uh-huh. He's like, I know more than you think I know. There were moments when I felt like he was crossing the line with me. And one night I was staying up, I was reading, I was writing, you know, and he said, come on, you need to go to sleep. I'm like, oh no, I'm gonna stay up, you know, good night. And he said, I said, you're going to sleep. That's when some of those unsettled emotions and feelings came to the surface again. It was at that moment that I thought, I definitely need to talk to him about some things. And I said, I have a bunch of questions. I said, are you ready to answer them? And he said, I don't know. He said, depends on what the questions are. So he's real stubborn. I didn't even know what first question to ask. I had so many questions. I said, I heard, you know, I started telling him rumors, not necessarily my mama said, but it was, I heard this, I heard that. I said, is that true? And he would never really admit to anything direct. He would say, oh, he said, some of it might be. And the turning point was when he said, you know, she was a good woman and I wasn't always a good man. That did something for me. I had a picture of my mom and the way he looked at that picture, it did a lot for me. He said, after a while, he stayed away because he didn't want me to. You know, he joked about it. He said, because I didn't want you to end up in here. He says, well, now that you're here. So we both kind of started laughing. I said, well, I'm not in here for the reasons you were in here. Well, you were a drug dealer. And you know what I mean? I'm a white collar offender, as they say. I think the changing moment was Dad was on medication. And one morning he didn't go over for his medication. And they kept calling him over the intercom. And I said, Mr. Milton. They're calling you. At that moment, I felt like, not on my watch, you know, you're not going to be sitting here and getting sick. He said he appreciated my concern. And I said, no problem, Dad. That was the first time I called him Dad, and it just rolled off my tongue. It wasn't deliberate or rehearsed or anything. And I said, did you hear that, Mr. Milton? I called you Dad. I said, what's that about? And he laughed. So then I kind of went back and forth with, you know, Mr. Milton, sir, or dad. My first Christmas with my dad was in the prison. I got my first birthday card from my dad in the prison. One day with my birthday card that I kept reading 100 times that day in the prison, I'm like, I love this guy. I really do. And I was shocked by it. I thought that was something that would take years. And, you know, I guess being forced to be with somebody up 24 hours a day, things do happen quickly.
After being locked up with his dad for 7.5 months, Roy was released early for good behavior. His dad had 3 more years of time to serve.
That was bittersweet because I looked over at my dad and he had his head down and we had become so close that He didn't want me to go, and I didn't want to leave him there. We didn't even say bye. It wasn't like, goodbye, see you next, you know, see you later. We just looked at each other. It was just that look. When I was riding home with my wife, because she asked me, she said, well, what did he say when you left? And, you know, I said, he didn't say anything. We just looked at each other. Ever since then, it's like we've always had relationship. You know, he fusses at me. He gets mad at me. I get mad at him. Like normal father and son. He's stubborn. I'm stubborn. But I know he loves me. You know, he does tell me that at every conversation. It's the last thing he says. I love you. I love you too.
Big thanks to Roy Smith for taking Snap with him on his journey. That piece, it was produced by Julia DeWitt. When Snap Judgment returns, we have a story of lost treasure finally found, and one lady who decides to rock her high school reunion like no one has ever rocked it before. For real, on Snap Judgment, the reunion episode continues. Stay tuned.
Need a new podcast to balance out your serious side? Well, let Pop Culture Happy Hour connect you with fun movies, creative books, and yes, good TV. Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. You can find it on iTunes under podcasts.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the reunion episode. Today on the show, that which is lost is found, and people are reunited in ways they never thought possible. For our next story, we sent Snap producer Pat Mesiti Miller to my hometown, Detroit, Michigan.
Meet Jeff. He runs a record store out in Detroit.
I'm Jeff Bubeck from UHF Records. UHF is a 95% vinyl, good old-fashioned record shop.
Got soul, R&B, blues, soundtrack, country, classic rock, pop.
I've collected my whole life. You know, I started 8 years old collecting records, and now I have, I mean, look around.
Place is covered.
Yeah.
In talking with Jeff, I was asking him where he gets all his records. He told me he hunts them down. He'll buy from collectors, go to estate sales.
You know, I've gone to storage auctions before, long before the Storage Wars and Pickers or any of those shows that are on now. It's nothing like that, really. I mean, there's, for the most part, there's garbage out there.
And then Jeff told me a story about one of his best finds in his decades of collecting. It started off when Jeff got a call from a woman who owned a storage locker. Apparently, somebody was years behind on rent and left behind a unit filled with records. So Jeff went and checked it out.
There was probably 6,000 records in there. Tons of 70s jazz. Really a lot of off-the-wall obscure stuff, you know? There was a little bit of everything in there. Boxes upon boxes stacked up. There was stuff that had gotten wet, you know, stuff that actually had black mold growing on it. I mean, it was just, you know what I mean? It was a mess.
But in looking through all the records, he saw some stuff that was worth investing in and bought them, and then paid to have them stored in the locker for a couple more months.
And one particular day, I went to the storage bin to pick up some boxes, and I noticed a tub in the back of the storage bin. And I opened the tub, and it was just full of cassettes. It was just, you know, mixtapes, homemade tapes, you know? And then there was some junk mail in there. All of the junk mail had the name Yancey on it. Maureen Yancey, and there were some pieces that said James Yancey. Didn't think twice of it. Another few days had passed, and I have no idea why I did it, but I Googled James Yancey. The first thing that popped up was the Wikipedia page for J. Dilla. Producer extraordinaire.
If you're not up on J. Dilla, the man is a legend. He was a producer behind tons of classic songs for artists like The Far Side, A Tribe Called Quest, De La Soul, Common, Busta Rhymes, Erykah Badu. In hip-hop circles, he's thought of as one of the greatest of all time. Can't keep running away.
And basically, I just turned to Tommy, my partner who was sitting next to me, and said, get the hell out of here. Do you know who I think this stuff belongs to? And basically, holy shit, you know what I mean? Wow. What are we going to do?
In 2006, Dilla passed away from complications from lupus. He was only 32. And since his death, people have been madly searching to find anything and everything Dilla related. So to find Jay's personal record collection, it was huge, because in it would be the records that Dilla had sampled and turned into hits.
The phone started ringing. There were calls. It was like instant backlash. Everyone wanted it, but then they also had a problem with me. What business does he have selling Jay's stuff? You know what I mean? That's what it was. Who the f*** are you?
People were going crazy over Dilla's record collection. But remember how Jeff said that there was a bunch of cassette tapes?
I opened the tub and it was just full of cassettes.
Some of those tapes Dilla had recorded on. They had titles like Beats and Rough Ideas, hinting at unreleased music. A beat tape from Dilla? That's gold. Yeah. Private collectors, fans, people were offering him tens of thousands of dollars to get a piece.
I'm human and I seen dollar signs for a minute. Even if I didn't take the offer from them, I could have put a cassette at a time up on eBay and probably made, loads of money.
A record label called him.
We understand that you found tapes containing Jay Dilla's music. The content of those tapes is our property. You'll be compensated for it, but we're coming to get it. It wasn't cool. I mean, it was chaos, and I was like, I wanted to do nothing but crawl under a rock, you know what I mean? Step back. I'm not taking calls. Leave me alone. The collection's gone. It's no longer on the premises. Go away.
And during all the madness, Jeff had something else on his mind.
Honestly, the first thing I thought of was that Wikipedia page. Due to Dilla's debt, the family receives no income from projects. Dilla's children are being supported by the Social Security from their mothers. Likewise, Miss Yancey still lives in the same Detroit ghetto, also in tremendous debt. After reading that, it says it right there. It's like, okay. And it's like, where's the money? Here's Maureen and his family, right in the same place they were back in the beginning, you know?
But how? How could it be that the mother of a platinum-selling producer would be in debt? I mean, he made hits. He was award-winning. So I called up Dilla's mom, Maureen, and she invited me over for a talk.
Come on in. Good to see you.
I'm Maureen Yancey. Jay Dilla is my son. He is the most genius beatmaker that ever existed. Although he's passed on, his work still lives.
Welcome to my humble abode. We're drinking some black coffee in a minute.
Okay, cool. Where we come from is a place we call Coney Gardens.
I visit her at her home, the same house that Jay grew up in, deep in Detroit, in Coney Gardens.
The neighborhood here is very, very urban, to say the least. It resembles, in some places, a war zone like Iraq, as you know. A lot of people have moved away because of the conditions in the city's lack of support in our area, as you can see. But then there are those that are dedicated to the community that try to keep it moving and that are proud to be here.
Maureen told me that the last couple years of Jay's life were mostly spent in the hospital, fighting his illness. Maureen stayed with him, helped nurse him. But while he was in the midst of all this treatment,
that a payment, it was late, and the insurance company did not honor it. And even though it might have been a day late, it didn't matter. Being an insurance company that's in it for profit, they dropped him. Because it had been like 4 years worth of this sickness going on. You know, he was so ill, of course they didn't want to pay for every hospital stay that he had. The last 9-10 months, everything was out of pocket. Every hospital stay, each bill averaged $250,000. That was a bi-monthly bill.
That's $250,000 twice a month. And that's not including flying out specialists or doctors or prescriptions. Dilla's illness was very expensive, and soon he fell into debt. And when Dilla's funds were gone, Maureen stepped up.
I didn't care what it was. I was going to sign my life away for them to give him all of the care that he needed, and which I did in certain instances, because when he didn't have insurance, I signed off on a lot of that. They said, well, you know, you'll be responsible. I did not care. I said, well, if I had to scrub hospital floors to work it off, you know.
So you went broke?
Oh, yeah. Had to. It's my son.
Maureen gave up near everything. She sold her house, closed down her business, all the while hoping Jay could beat the sickness and get back to the work he loved. He lived for music. I mean, the man was a powerhouse. Even when his health didn't improve, Maureen, with some friends, set up music equipment right in his hospital room, and he worked. It was there that he created his last album, Donuts.
Okay, okay. There comes a time.
It was released 3 days before he passed.
People, the time.
There to date has been no compensation from the estate to any of the heirs.
And 6 years after Dilla had been gone, Maureen was still struggling. And when Jeff, who had found himself sitting on a potential gold mine of music, heard about that?
That really, you know, that struck a chord with me. I just felt, you know, it was just such an injustice. I'll be damned if I'm giving it to any record company. In the moment, I just was trying to do the right thing, you know what I mean?
So Jeff got in touch with Maureen. She drove across the city, and they met at the storage facility.
And he unlocks this, like a garage, you know, door.
Went back into the bin and pulled the tub out from the back. And
he just shows me the bins that were too heavy to lift. And so I'm looking, and I'm like, what in the world, you know?
And I popped open the lid. And it was silence for a few minutes. And that moment, it's like she's seen him again, you know what I mean? Because just the silence there, and it was like, this is heavy.
When I saw my son's handwriting, God, that was something profound. He wrote notes in there about things that he wants to do for me. To see those notes and to hear his voice as I read them, I could hear him saying it. It just touched me to touch my heart to no end.
It was her son's stuff, you know. I told her, take it with you. It's yours. Take it. And gave her a hug, and, you know, she was thrilled. It felt really good that she had it again. You know, it was like, yeah, back in the right hands.
And though some of them looked like they'd have some of Dilla's music on them, most of the cassettes, well, they were just regular tapes, like you used to be able to buy at the store. Today, you probably wouldn't pay 10 cents for them at a flea market. But in talking with one of Dilla's close friends,
Frank Nitz suggests, I think you better listen to them because your son hid a lot of music in his tapes.
Maureen sat down, loaded up the tapes, pressed play, and
I was blown away, my mouth dropped. From the very first one, it was stuff on it that we had never heard before.
Turn it up, baby.
I didn't expect to hear his voice in any of the music. He's not sick, he's not suffering, and he's just live to his fullest capacity.
On the hundreds of cassettes that Maureen now has, Dilla had left music, and lots of it.
The material is, oh my, it was overwhelming. There are in the high hundreds of tracks.
Hours and hours and hours of unreleased Dilla music was found on the cassettes. And along with some studio master reels, Maureen says there's enough material for never-before-heard music to be coming out for years.
It's the Lost Scrolls. It's the Lost Scrolls. The reason for titling it the Lost Scrolls is because it has a spiritual meaning. It's like the Ark of the Covenant for me. And
I was invited to hear the coveted Lost Scrolls. Now trust me, these recordings are well guarded, but Maureen let me record a small piece of our time listening together.
So how does it feel to be listening to this music?
I feel simply wonderful listening to my son's creations. It's none like it. He is the master, and my heart is happy. My ears are happy, you know. I can feel his soul in his music. Dilla was my backbone, my support, because we had a bond that was so special with our love for music and our desire to help the other one get to where they wanted to be in this world. We already were close, and then the nursing home in California, we were more one than ever. So when he left, I was standing alone. I never mourned normally, not knowing whether to be angry or to cry. I couldn't cry. I hadn't shed a tear. At his funeral, I didn't cry. People were waiting for me to break down, which I didn't even understand. Why no tears? I was in denial of everything, and I just had this void. Then, through the heart of a good man, Jeff Bubeck, God would open up a door and give me pieces of my son back. It was held back for this time. It wasn't meant for me to have it before now. And it brought back what Dilla said to me in California. He was in the wheelchair. He grabbed my hands, both of them. And he said, I want to thank you for all that you have done. And I want you to know you're going to be all right. I promise you. You're going to be all right. You know.
How are you doing? You okay?
I'm fine.
Take a break?
No.
No?
It's the first tear. I guess I needed that. I think it's the first one since he passed. Thanks for that. Let me turn that water faucet on. Because I always hold it back. He has proven to me that he's looking out for me. And I'm looking at him, he's looking at me right now, saying, lady, I told you would be all right.
Maureen Yancey has begun releasing the music found on the tapes, The Lost Scrolls, as she continues her work with the J. Dilla Foundation to raise awareness about lupus and inspire young people around the world. Maureen is also working on a book and a film about Dilla's life and legacy, we'd have links to all of these great projects on our website, snapjudgment.org. A huge thanks to Maureen Yancey and Jeff Bubeck for sharing their story. And special thanks as well to Jonathan Taylor and Tate McBroom for their help. And if you listen to this show at all, you know we owe a debt to Dilla himself.
Thank you.
That piece was produced by Pat the CD Miller. When Snap Judgment returns, we show you how to attend that high school reunion the way you always dreamed about, for real. When Snap Judgment, the reunion episode continues, stay tuned.
What do you want to do this weekend? I know what you don't want to do. You don't want to spend your weekend looking for things to do. Be ready. Pop Culture Happy Hour is NPR's podcast that connects you with cool and creative books, movies, and television. Pop Culture Happy Hour. It will make your weekend. Find it on iTunes under podcasts. You want to keep that?
From PRX to NPR, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the reunion episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today on the show, we're revisiting issues from time past. Now, sensitive listeners and those with young children should know that this story does contain some actions your mother would never approve of. And we here at Snap Judgment, we certainly don't approve either. Our own Stephanie Fu, in conversation with Andrea Wachner, has the story.
In high school, Andrea Wachner acted in Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. She was third serving wench.
In high school, I was a total drama geek. I was in all the plays and thespian club.
And at Palos Verdes Peninsula High, being third serving wench was not very cool. The school's in Southern California.
The kind of place where when you came back from summer vacation, people would have different noses. And on your 16th birthday, it was pretty standard practice to receive a brand new BMW or a Mercedes.
So even though nobody bullied her or anything like that, Andrea just felt left out.
I felt like I did not fit in. And so then it becomes, well, how do I make it through every day? How do I get out of here alive? So I tried to make it as fun as I could. I played games. I told jokes. I played pranks on people. I got in trouble in class. I was a smartass. I was more than relieved to get out of there. In fact, I vowed never to return.
And she didn't. After graduation, Andrea moved across the country to New York, and she pretty much forgot about high school until 10 years later.
Getting the invitation to my high school reunion was as if I had received a piece of mail that was covered in spiders. I think I literally dropped it to the floor and screamed. It was terrifying. It was horrifying. A lot of people that may or may not have known me trapped inside of a room. And that's when it hit me that this was a room full of sitting ducks. There was a way to sort of play with that situation. You know, what's the best, worst thing I could do in this situation? I had the idea to send someone in my stead. I think Stripper was the first that I had.
Yes, Andrea decided to hire a stripper to impersonate her at her high school reunion.
It was such a great fit.
Because a stripper would be like the most unlikely thing for you to have become?
Yeah, no one's gonna look at me and be like, that's a sex pot. Yeah, sure, it says a lot about what I think about my own sexuality. But I mean, the whole point of reunion is to put your best foot forward. And I say I took the notion of a high school reunion and I flipped it on its head. So I had to make two trips to California before the actual reunion to sort of find out where the reunion was and scoping out the scene and getting prepared and go stripper shopping. And I had never been to a strip club before, so then I quickly realized that strippers don't look like me.
And what do you look like, to clarify?
What do I look like? Anne Frank. It was so funny. It was like, with every girl that took the stage, it was less and less likely that she could be me. Like, the first woman was African American. The next woman was like 70 years old. And then the next lady was a beautiful Hawaiian girl. And it was just like, oh my God. But then this dancer named Cricket was introduced. And the second she took the stage, it was a transcendental love at first sight kind of moment. She was absolutely breathtaking. And literally before I could even finish my question, she said yes.
So she looked kind of like you.
I kind of think she looks more like Bjork than like me. But with the glasses, it was not as hard to sell.
But really, pulling this off was going to be much more complicated than finding a vaguely Jewish-looking stripper. And if it worked, she wanted a souvenir. So she decided to get the entire thing on camera.
So I hired one of the sound guys from the show Punk'd, and he brought a crew with him.
A crew which set up a headquarters in a room they rented directly above the ballroom where the reunion was to take place.
So we had two cameras following Cricket around all night. The main camera had wireless transmission, so I could see whatever that camera was filming. And so Cricket had a tiny wireless earpiece in her ear, and she had a microphone that was hooked into her bra. So I could hear everything that she was saying, and so I could feed her information right into her ear.
The night of the reunion, Cricket waltzed into the headquarters late.
She's wearing this black lace silk slip as a dress, black and white thigh highs. She has 8.5-inch platform patent leather stiletto boots. She's got a full face of makeup that includes bedazzling. And as she was leaving, I felt a little bit like a coach sending their team off to play. And I tried to give her like a rallying, come to Jesus kind of pep talk. No matter what they say, no matter what happens, you are Andrea Walkner. Do not back down.
And then Andrea Walkner sent Andrea Walkner into the lion's den. Or the panther's den, rather. That's their mascot.
She walked in and it's like this huge crowd, right? And they're all drinking and they all know each other and she knows no one. And literally within the first, I think, minute, she's like making her way to the bar. She literally dove boob first into this crowd and she bumped into someone and she goes,
"Oh, did my get in the way? Sorry."
It was just amazing. She walked right up to people and was introducing herself as me. And I could see in the background right away that people were pointing at her and pointing at her boots and going, "No way. No way. That is not her." I informed her that all this was going on behind her back. So she would walk right up to them and be like, "Hi, how are you?
It's been a while. Thank you. You look good too. How have you been?"
You know, and there were certainly people who wanted proof right off the bat that she was her. You know, tell me something that only Andrea would know. Or and I started to try, if I had a chance, I would give her something. That usually was like the first thing that popped into my head about someone, which one of the best examples of it working was this guy that I grew up with. And we have the same birthday.
"You have the same birthday as me. How have you been?"
"It is you, because you know that."
"Yes."
For the most part, everyone there believed it was me.
And here's the ironic thing. The fact that Cricket hadn't gone to school with any of these people, that actually kind of helped her fit in better.
Everybody else came into it with so much pretense, and she had none of it. She walked into this situation with wide eyes and a genuine interest in everyone. That's what made her win them over, right? She was interested in who they were in a way that other people weren't necessarily.
But even though Andrea's classmates liked Cricket enough as a novelty, cracking jokes and dancing with her, most of them wanted to eat dinner in polite company. In other words, no strippers allowed.
Dinner was a buffet. Nobody wanted her to sit at their table with them. They were pretty rude, actually. There were clearly open seats and they told her that it was taken or whatever. And it was like the cliche of being in high school and trying to find a spot to sit in the cafeteria. Like, where do I belong and who should I sit with? She finally found her spot with the band geeks. And I just thought that was so lovely. So thank you to the band geeks. we had decided that she was definitely going to dance. That was kind of like, if you're going to send a stripper to your high school reunion, she kind of has to strip. So I sort of reflected on my high school years and I picked the song that I thought was the most poignant. I picked Stay by Lisa Loeb. So she just dragged a chair from one of the tables up to the dance floor and just had a go at it.
You say I only hear what I want to.
I just sat there and watched in complete awe. Everybody whipping out whatever device they had to document it. People were literally running back into the ballroom from outside in the hallway. And then there, you know, was a whole contingency of people who were horrified and offended. And then there were some really fun ladies who were like screaming, take it all off. They went up, threw money at her, which my favorite part of the story is they picked up off the floor and took back afterwards. I don't quite understand that. She was just incredible. Incredible.
Yeah, I missed you.
As soon as she was done, as soon as the song ended, she informed us.
I lost the earpiece. The earpiece fell out.
So that was probably the most stressful. And I'm an idiot screaming into the microphone.
It's on the floor. It's on the dance floor right in front of you. Right in front of you. Right in front of you. Oh, she can't hear me. She can't hear me.
I actually lost an earring. I need it fine.
But we eventually found it and put it back in and it was fine. We stayed there for probably, I'd say, another half an hour. She gave some lap dances and was informed that whether she was me or not, they liked her better, which I think is, you know, the message to take away from all of this.
Eventually, the camera crew and Cricket came back up to the hotel room.
What I thought was so amazing about Cricket was the first thing she said was, "Now I understand why you didn't want to go." I was glad I had done it, and I was so thankful. I was just amazed at how well it had gone, and I knew right away that I had more than enough material to make something good.
Andrea started to cut together a short documentary of her night.
And at some point, I put the 6-minute trailer up on YouTube, and somebody contacted me from abcnews.com. She asked if she could interview me.
Andrea's story went online in the middle of the night.
And at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, my landline started ringing off the hook. And by 10 o'clock that morning, Good Morning America had a whole film crew in my living room. And the whole thing just sort of exploded. And then certainly the cat was out of the proverbial bag.
So this was the first time that most of Andrea's classmates realized that they hadn't partied with the real Andrea.
I was threatened with several lawsuits. One person in particular, it surprises me that she's upset because we actually were friends in high school. And that is interesting because you would think that if they knew me, then they shouldn't be surprised or upset. But at the same time, it's like, well, of course it's them, because why would anyone else care? There are some horribly mean things that people said. I'm not talking superficial mean, like she's ugly, which I got a lot of that too. Somebody said, don't feel too bad, guys. Her dad died a few years ago and she deserved it, or, you know, something like that. How can that not hurt? It, of course, makes you feel guilty, and I wouldn't be human if it didn't. You know, a lot of people accused me of exploiting them and the night, and certainly I did. And, you know, my therapist can give you a dollar amount on how much I have spent talking to her about it.
But a lot of that guilt dissipated as more emails started coming in. Turned out, there were plenty of people who hated high school just as much as she did.
I heard from a lot of people from my class that also didn't go to the reunion and heard about it and took the time to reach out to me and tell me how funny they thought it was. And it made me realize, like, these are the people I should have known in high school, and I didn't take the time to know them. And I should have, because maybe I would have had a better time. But this actually brought them to the foreground in a way that they never would have otherwise.
So this actually facilitated, like, a better reunion for you. It did all the things that a reunion's supposed to do.
Have you kept in contact with any of them?
Yeah, I have more friends on Facebook from my high school than I should rightfully have. I have no regrets about doing it. What I've come to learn about myself is that I'm a late bloomer. At the 10-year mark, I was not ready. Now I could say that, yeah, there are some people I would genuinely like to know again.
Being attractive is the most important thing there is. If you want to catch the biggest fish in your pond, you have to be as attractive as possible.
If you want to see cricket in action, head on over to snapjudgment.org or iRememberAndrea.com. Where Andrea Walkner's documentary will be available for the very first time. That story was produced by Stephanie Fu. I know what you're thinking. That's not enough Snap. I need more. The Snap Judgment Podcast. Full episodes, pictures, stuff. Available for you right now, Snap Nation, at snapjudgment.org. Twitter, snapjudgment.org. Yes, Snap is on the Facebook. Snap was produced by myself and the most magnificent band of magically musical maestros. Please make a joyful noise for the uber producer himself, Mr. Mark Ristich. Continue the applause, if you would, for Pat Mesiti-Miller, Anna Sussman, Stephanie Fu, Julia DeWitt, Nick Vanderkolk, Renzo Gorio, Jasmine DaCosta, Beth Morgan, Mood Zadie, Nicholas Lafredo, and Will Urbina. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting has absolutely not granted me the power to speak on their behalf. Snap deeply regrets any announcements to the contrary. Much love, the CPB. PRX goes by PRX for short, PRX.org. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could have been picked on in high school, spend 25 years planning your revenge, and when you run into the auditorium to release the hounds and the doggies start growling at you instead, you would still not be as far away from the news as this is, but this is NPR.